one of the things I think firmly is a gap for us is we tend to promote time to baseline production as our key metric. I think in our system, and this is an owner driven decision, we want negative as fast as we can. We figure that every additional week of positive pigs is costing you $10 or $12 times the number of pigs you're weaning. And those weeks at the end of the outbreak, you're back at full production. So each of those weeks is it's a high dollar cost. You know, if you go 10 weeks longer than you need to on a 2,500 or a 5,000 cell farm, you could easily be at $250,000 or $500,000 of cost of being positive for those additional weeks. And there's a lot of virus put out in the industry on those weeks. So being negative sooner, I think, is a real key for eradication.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. Summer challenges finish your pig performance. Digestrum Finish can help. Learn more at dsm-firmenich.com/finish. Adiseo provides programs and services to help producers achieve their targets in high-quality, safe, and sustainable way. SUNY, we provide value-added biotech solutions.
Hello, and welcome to the Swine It podcast show. I'm Dr. Tara Donovan, your host, and I have two guests on my show today. First, please meet Dr. Neil DeBuse. Neil is a veterinarian at Kalmbach Feeds, and I have a return guest, Dr. Steve Tusina with Vaccinova. Welcome to our show, Neil and Steve. How are you guys today?
Very good. Thanks.
Thanks, Terry. Yeah, I'm doing great. Nice sunny weather here in Ohio today.
Great. So today we're going to discuss PRRS autogenous vaccines and include one system's approach to managing PRRS in their system. With PRRS continuing to be the number one health threat to U.S. swine herds, there's always new information we can learn. But before we jump into more about PRRS, I'd like to invite our guests to introduce themselves just a little bit more. Neil, tell us about yourself.
I'm a Colorado native, graduated from Colorado State University in 1992, so it makes me 30 years plus of being a veterinarian, and have had a chance to travel quite a bit internationally and in the U.S. in several different production systems. So swine was always my interest from the day I started vet school, so this has been kind of a dream career for me.
Great. And Neil, you're with Kalmbach. Tell us just a little bit about where that is and what you do for them.
I have been consulting with Kalmbach Feeds and Paul Kalmbach since about 2008. I did some genetic things and some PRRS things helping them in their production system. And 3 years ago this week, I joined as a full-time veterinarian. So I've been here 3 years. The Kalmbach system is obviously Kalmbach is a well-known feed brand, but we have a fairly critical part of the company in pork production. We do produce about 1.2 million wean pigs, and we finish about, let's say, three quarters of those within our system or within closed partners. Most of those pigs go to Indiana PAC in Indiana. We are also a partner in a pork slaughterhouse in Sandusky, Ohio, called Ruth Packing.
Great. Thank you for that. I appreciate it. And Steve, tell us a little bit about yourself. You've been on our show before, but just in case our audience didn't tune in.
Yeah, sure. Just a brief reintroduction of myself. So Steve Tusina, I'm a 2011 graduate of the University of Minnesota. After graduating vet school, I did a PhD in epidemiology with Dr. Bob Morrison, focusing on the PRRS incidence within the U.S. sow herd. From there, I went into private practice for a few years. And after that, my career in technical services started at Boehringer Ingelheim. This is where I started to really appreciate the role of autogenous vaccines in pork production today. And recently joined it's been about 4 years now that I've been with the Vaccinova team helping to put together autogenous vaccine programs with customers that we work with.
Great. Thank you for that. So we're talking about PRRS today, everybody's probably least favorite topic, but definitely a necessary one as we continue to battle it out in the field. So Neil, let's start with you. You mentioned your work with Kalmbach and managing PRRS in their swine production system. Would you share your approach to PERS management there?
You know, to start with, I think it's always interesting to know the background of the production system and some statistics. You know, I've been in a couple other production systems that didn't have a good success controlling PERS, but we're in a fairly low pig dense area. Of the sow farms that we own and manage, both own and manage, we have some that we just manage. You know, we typically over the last 15 years have had about a 10% outbreak rate per year. You know, so 1.2 sow farms per year, nothing exciting. This last year was a little exciting. We've had four in the winter of 2025, in spring 2026. So not typical right now. So I don't want to tell you that we're coming into this as some success story. PERS is, I think, a growing threat. And I think the emergence of some of these new, hyper prolific, that's not the right word for PERS, I think better suited for gilts, but these high rate of replicating viruses have really been a challenge, I think, for the whole industry. And so we generally have about a third of our herds are naive, but with multiplication and a couple of commercial herds, and about two thirds are vaccinated farms where they're not just vaccinated with a modified live vaccine, but they're vaccinated with modified live and followed up with a killed vaccine. And I really, one of the things I wanted to talk about today is I really think that, and I don't know how we've done it, but I've used killed PERS vaccine multiple times, multiple different production systems through my career. And I think we're overlooking that it could be valuable in taking away some other risks that we face with these new, especially with recombination of PERS viruses in the field. So what I'd add to that is that about 5 years ago, I'd been in Russia for about a year and I came back and I spoke to Paul Kalmbach and we really laid out a plan 5 years ago that we really wanted to stay ahead of recombination. There had been a recombination case in Denmark that was fairly well publicized at the time. And we took some steps at that point really to change the way we did things. And as I was telling Steve, I think that one day we're going to wake up and realize that putting two viruses in the same pig at the same time is something we just got to stop doing. And I think we do it more often than we become a little bit numb to it. We do it, we put in modified live on top of a field virus or a field virus on top of a modified live fairly frequently. And so we put some procedures in place where we basically stopped using MLV in the face of an outbreak in a sow farm 5 years ago. We're happy with that decision. And when we use modified live in the field, we're often coupling it with a killed PERS vaccine that would control that modified live. I think in general, one of my worries in multiple locations, but in our system here, we place a lot of negative pigs and, you know, the positive pigs next door could be a problem. Positive pigs on one side and vaccinated pigs on another side could be another problem. So I think the viruses tend to move and our negative sites could be a mixing vessel for new viruses, you know, depending on what else is going on. So we generally are using a killed PERS vaccine in combination with a modified live whenever we do that today. You know, the Morrison, the Minnesota Swine Health Monitoring Program that Bob and Steve set up, it shows how cyclical PERS is and how I think one thing that has got to be driving that is that we've got a lot of negative finishing sites coming into the fall every year. And it's got to be something we look at. If you look at the success of the pseudorabies program, completely different disease, completely different genome and stuff. But I think the success of it was there was an effective way of creating immunity in 50-pound pigs. Otherwise, we'd never succeeded. You know, there were effective vaccines. And so our system relies heavily on killed PERS vaccine in combination with modified live in acclimation programs and in placing pigs into finishing.
So Neil, you mentioned it in your early part of your discussion, recombination. So just in case some of our listeners aren't familiar with that or maybe need a bit of a recap, or Steve, would one of you just describe what that is in terms of the PERS virus and then how does that happen?
Simply put, it's just this ability of two viruses when commingling within a naive host, you've got this opportunity for genes to swap between these viruses. And anytime this happens, we run the risk of new things starting to emerge from there. And potentially they can become more virulent viruses or more You know, they replicate at a higher rate. You know, typically if, you know, one of these recombination events favors the survival or the propagation of these viruses, they can become very apparent within a population in a short period of time. So quite in my mind, that's the simple answer to it. But, you know, from a clinical perspective, maybe Neil would have something else to add.
You know, I've shared this article from Denmark pretty widely, Tara, and I shared with Steve. There's a paragraph in there that when you read it, it's just like, wow, that's how that all happened. you know, basically the way the article, I was trying to be as simple as it said, but there's a farm that used two modified live vaccines. One vaccine was used in the sows and another one was used in the weaned pigs. Somehow that recombined in summer of 2019 in Denmark, became virulent and affected like 38 farms and a boar set. It affected a boar set, and that's how it got to the 38 farms. But I don't think very many people think about, hey, we're using modified live here. We're going to use LVI in the pig, in the sows. We're going to use LVI in the gilts, or we're going to use MLV in the sows. It's a real simple thing that if a pig gets infected with two viruses at the same time, it's possible, not always, but it's possible for a new virus to emerge. And I think one thing that bothers me the most probably about our approach on finishing vaccination with just modified live is that we know in gilts, We need the immunity to mature on gilts. So when we're acclimating, we know we need 4 months or 5 months. And successful gilt acclimation programs, we all know what they are, because we let that immunity mature. But we really don't have that opportunity in finishing without doing something else to speed up development of that immunity. We did a study not here at Kallenbach, but with fairly close association with Kallenbach after the fact, back in 2010. And what we showed is by coupling a modified live vaccine in nursery with a killed vaccine 3 weeks later at placement and finishing, we were able to reduce mortality for the circulating field viruses by about 6%. And that we did that on 40,000 finishing spaces, center of Iowa, high pig dense area. So it really led to what we're doing today. But I think that the killed vaccine can have a benefit of changing that immune response, speeding it up, helping it mature quicker. I think more work's done on that, needs to be done on that. I refer back to, on immunity, I refer back to Osorio's work in 2002 as the ideal chart. I just love to see that chart reproduced in what we've been doing for the last 15 years on this combined approach. I think it's clearly different because we have clearly different results. But I strayed off your topic there a little bit, Tara. The worry I have today on recombination, if you go back to this 2020 L1C144, and you look at the work that Minnesota did in developing that, they were able to determine when they did further analysis that there are six recombination events represented in that virus. So it wasn't a simple Denmark two modified live viruses recombining. These are field viruses recombining. And I think what I recently spoke with Dr. Cesar Corso at Minnesota, and his worry is that there's been a quantum change when that came along that's allowed that virus to change and recombine more easily after the fact. There's something of a cassette of genes there, a cassette of the genome that's allowed it to change more rapidly after that. So recombination is something we've been missing in the U.S. industry. I think it happens thousands of times a week. The ones that are really important show up, you know, they show up over and over again as new isolates emerge. So
I'll add to that too. Technology like whole genome sequencing has come so far, so quickly, in the computing power required to do some of these analyses is becoming more and more accessible than it's been in the past. And so I think to Neil's point, I think we're going to start to develop a greater level of awareness that this is happening. And then, you know, what impact that has on production, and then long-term, how do we control it? So technology is really becoming a very powerful tool for us to do a better job of detecting and describing these things today.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. And it's exciting that it's going to, you know, help us to gather all that data, not only within a system like Kallenbach, but maybe neighborhoods, areas, regions, states, to get better at deciding, you know, what our next step is.
That's right.
So on that, real quick question, I'm sure some of the audiences also has this question. So how do you decide what virus or what what to include in an autogenous vaccine. You know, give me a bit of some detail on that. So modified live, they're available, commercially available, right? We don't change the strain that's in that bottle, but on autogenous, you pick something that's in the herd or in the area that's coming at you. And so how do you do that? And perhaps it's using genome sequencing.
You know, I think within a production system, you always have a collection of viruses that are significant to that production system. Today we use a 5-strain a vaccine on the sow farms. Generally, 4 of those have come from our system, specifically viruses from individual outbreaks that have occurred over, let's say, over the last 2 to 3 years. And we'll upgrade those. If we see something emerging, we'll try to upgrade that going into fall. But we usually reserve 1 spot in there for the modified live virus vaccine that we're using as the priming dose for our gilts. So in the past, and anybody who wants to contact me from the industry on this, I'm not doing it for any other reason than to be protective, but we used the modified live vaccine from BI for years on acclimating gilts. A very consistent product, but we put it in there so we would neutralize that so the immunity could develop for the other strains, you know, when they were exposed to that. Today we use Prevacent, and the Prevacent strain or a close replicate of it is in the vaccine. And sometimes we'll get a Prevacent-like vaccine out of finishing, and we'll use that as the base. But I make no bones about it. We're doing that to help control the modified live, so it's not 90 days in a finishing site where that virus could be shedding. You know,
continuing to replicate.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. And I would say that I give a lot of credit to Dr. Lynette Holman. We set up a monitoring program here for gilt isolation. We generally have four age groups of gilts in that, but our use of the killed vaccine that we use today, after we do 2 doses of priming with modified live, we can detect those pigs 30 days later negative and consistently stay negative. Where in the past, if you just did the modified live, you might have detectable oral fluids virus all the way out to 90 days. You know, so it's given us a very, and across all the sow farms that we do that, it's been a very consistent diagnostic picture on those cases. I imagine we have 12 years of 15 farms with that diagnostic profile. It's one of the most repeatable patterns we've ever seen. But we make those pigs are negative within 30 days of completing that first killed vaccine. So,
Steve, anything to add?
I think just kind of the important highlight here is the commitment to the diagnostics, I think, is really important, trying to understand PERS situation within a system. We also have some nice information now coming from places like the University of Minnesota project that spun out of the PERS incidence project, is this virus under monitoring report that gives us kind of some understanding of what might be going on around us. And so, you know, we're sometimes looking at that question, well, is this a one-time event? Is this something weird that we're detecting? Or is it part of some pattern, you know, a larger pattern that's around us? And oftentimes I think that can help influence decision-making with how you want to proceed against PERS virus.
Yeah, absolutely. And that actually brings up my next question. And Neil brought up a virus that we kind of have been hearing for a while, right? L1C. Let's talk about PERS nomenclature really quick, because that report that you're talking about, you know, is grouping these viruses, right, in a little bit different way than what we might be had been using 10 years ago. Do you want to cover that briefly, Neil?
The whole industry here in the U.S. and worldwide really relies on the OR5 sequence to categorize these viruses. And that may be perfect. For sure, the new nomenclature that's come out, which I'm 110% behind. I think we were holding ourselves back with the RFLP. I think we were hiding some important information about isolates that I can only imagine what this VUM report would look like if we had 10 more years of data on it. I think we're going to kick ourselves if we didn't do that quicker. But it's really, I give a lot of credit to University of Minnesota on developing that. I think the nomenclature is great. But if there's one caveat in it, is, you know, we did do some whole genome sequencing on these four PERS outbreaks we had this year. And the virus we're dealing with in 3 of the 4 of those is a lineage 1C5.35. And one of them is a L1C5.32, which is the really predominant one in that report, the only one that's at a level 4 of transmission. And we had, when we went back through the investigation, we had one isolate in a wean to finish site around Thanksgiving time, and then we had two outbreaks at basically December 1st. When you do the whole genome sequence on that, you'd think that that maybe they're all the same on OR5. They're 100% match on OR5, but there are some really critical differences in that case in NSP1 and another NSP1 and NSP1B, I think they called it, where it's clearly not the same virus. It clearly epidemiologically wasn't linked to that winged finch site. It was linked elsewhere. So while I love what we're seeing as a better scientific way of naming them, I think we've got to be open to, there may be some things we need to add on to it as we learn more on the whole genome sequencing.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it gives us perhaps an interesting insight into, I'm sure, a situation that many of us have faced in our careers is, you know, it didn't always seem like all 144s maybe behaved the same. You know, sometimes you would hear just horror stories. In other places, people thought, well, maybe I could live with it. And it left a lot of us, I think, scratching our heads. Well, what else? Why is that, right? Like, what's going on here? And I think, you know, with the newer nomenclature system that we have, it's allowed us, I think, to sharpen that pencil, look a little bit differently at that ORF5. And, you know, I think it gives us a new set of testable hypotheses of, you know, maybe we need to be thinking differently about what virus we actually had in hand all along and what we want to be doing moving forward.
Yep, absolutely. So what are current gaps? What should we be doing or looking at moving forward?
You know, we have used in the work we've done on the killed PRRS vaccine, I really think that one of our gaps is, you know, a good immunologist or a grad student studying immunology to re-examine Osorio's work and show, hey, what happens when you combine vaccines? And Tara, when I've talked with Steve about this, it bothers me really that we've been using the same protocol for about 15 years. But, you know, 2010 to 2026, it goes fast, right? But I think that we're wrong to just sit on that protocol and not try to improve it. I don't know if we can improve it. You know, that original, we gave the MLV vaccine 3 weeks before the killed. Today, we give them at the same time. We give them at the same time on a wean pig, and we give them at the same time on a feeder pig. But I'd be happy to give two doses if I knew two doses was better. I'd be happy to change the combination, the sequence, if I knew it was better. I think there's so much possibility there that we haven't even looked at. And I think we haven't looked at it for a couple of reasons. But, you know, when you get an approval for a modified live vaccine, you don't have to add anything to it. When you try to get approval on a large scale for killed PRRS vaccine, that hasn't been very successful. The idea to combine them doesn't make any logical sense to most people, probably. But practically, it is working very well, you know. So I was telling Steve, I attended the PRRS symposium in Chicago in January, and I was really disappointed, Tara, to see we've got grad students studying all the modified live vaccines, like one of them is going to be superior to the others in two universities. I think this immunology and some, you know, where we've been using something, and I'm not the only veterinarian, but there's probably I'd say 50 to 60 veterinarians have been using the same product that we've been using for 5 or 6 years. That should be kind of a platform that we're studying. You know, how do we make it better? And with autogenous, it's just a little tough to get that research funding to do it. It may be at an industry level, we could accomplish something that we can't do from a company standpoint.
Yeah, I think if you listen to the AASV meeting, you know, Dr. Reed Phillips had a nice pathway, right, laid out to what science do we already have and what things do we already know and what are we lacking in terms of, you know, his discussion was in terms of, you know, PRRS eradication, right, which what do we need and what do we know? And I think that was an area, continued work on vaccine and use in the field and getting away from, you know, live virus. And you know, the other alternative is perhaps using more killed. So, yeah, I think that's a good discussion.
I think along those lines, you know, there was a really good article. I think, Roger Main and Scott D and some other people were on it at AVMA letter earlier, like January this year. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I think firmly, is a gap for us is we tend to promote time to baseline production as our key metric. I think in our system, And this is an owner-driven decision, we want negative as fast as we can. We figure that every additional week of positive pigs is costing you $10 or $12 times the number of pigs you're weaning. And those weeks at the end of the outbreak, you're back at full production. So each of those weeks is it's a high dollar cost. You know, if you go 10 weeks longer than you need to on a 2,500 or a 5,000 cell farm, you could easily be at $250,000 or $500,000 of cost of being positive for those additional weeks. And there's a lot of virus put out in the industry on those weeks. So being negative sooner, I think, is a real key for eradication. And anything we can do to improve on that really is important. So
where should the industry be investing for PRRS?
That's a good question. You know, a lot of people in the industry would say we've invested enough. You know, I think producers, when they fund it on these National Pork Board initiatives, they say, hey, haven't we funded that already? I think that what we've done on the variant under monitoring, that report, I think that there's some more development there that's going to continue to be very good. I had a really in-depth discussion with Roger Main here at Iowa State recently, and Roger and I had worked together down in Oklahoma for 3 years. And what I suggested to him is on this whole genome sequencing, when you get an isolate like L1C532, where it's really prolific, there's something really different about that virus. Maybe every 10 or 20 cases, we ought to do a whole genome sequence. See what is changing about that virus as it goes through the industry. Is it the same? Are we missing something at the OR5 level that we detect at the whole genome sequencing level? So if we've got the computing power that Steve talked about, I suggested Roger, I just think that on a really high prolific virus like that, we need to make sure we're tracking anything that's any adverse changes that make it speed up, I think, are a concern.
Yeah, and I think, you know, even putting it into naive pigs, right, in a BSL level facility to understand exactly, you know, the dynamics of that particular virus, shedding perhaps, or virulence, multiplication, you know, definitely not a virologist, but, you know, using those areas to understand that particular virus and why is it, what happened.
I think it's interesting that as an industry, it kind of felt like we had PRRS fatigue and we really went away from it, really putting our emphasis on it. And unfortunately, it's drug itself back to center stage with this recent initiative from National Pork Board. So, you know, I think that Steve and I've talked a little bit about this, Tara. I don't know. I certainly wouldn't want to limit the number of options for it, but I think that a critical point that we've really just never put enough emphasis on is how can we make a 50-pound finishing pig immune faster than just giving a modified live, just a dose or two doses? And I guess most of those pigs just get a single dose of modified live. We don't want to touch them twice, but what will make those pigs immune faster? And if I had an unlimited budget, I'd be spending a lot of time on that. The other thing I think that, you know, it's not a popular opinion, let's say opinion today, but, you know, a couple of years ago, I really respect Cesar Corso, University of Minnesota, at the NPIC meeting, he stood up and he said, hey, maybe we should stop putting modified live on top of field virus when we have sow farm breaks. And, Steve and I tried to thrash this out on Friday a little bit, but, you know, if you think about that time to negative, and if you think about, you know, if virus is crossing the placenta, do you want two viruses crossing the placenta into a pig that doesn't have a competent immune system? Because those pigs are going to last a while in the system, you know. So, Tara, I honestly believe that one day in the next 2 years, we're going to wake up and stop doing that. And if you read the article from Denmark and said, oh, I did this in the wean pigs and I did this in the sows, and saw the recombination, I think we'd stop faster. We've stopped here 5 years ago. I think the industry is going to stop that. You know, a lot of those vaccines were never approved to give to pregnant sows. So I find it tough to believe that we keep doing it and don't recognize that it could be as dangerous as using LVI. You know, when we use LVI, which is sparingly, and I would say our use of killed vaccine reduced our use of LVI by 80% or more over the last 15 years. But LVI has one virtue, is that it is the virus in the herd. And if your goal is just to get everybody exposed to that virus, it is the only tool for that job today. Not that I want to promote it. I think with killed vaccine, we could reduce it by 80%. So I argue for it, but against it at the same time. So,
and it's an age-old discussion, right? And our podcast today probably definitely won't be able to cover all the aspects of that debate, right? But you're right. I think looking back, 25, 30 years of doing the same thing is not working. So we definitely need to be thinking differently and if our programs are the same as they were 15 years ago. I think it's a good discussion to have to question that and what are we missing? What do we need to go experiment with?
If you'll let me, there's one thing I thought I owed it to all the production veterinarians to say here. You know, when we start talking about eradication, and if you're in a production system, your eyes kind of roll. Because if you've ever been through a season of every farm breaking with PRRS in your system, you realize that all of your teammates, from the owner to the guy power washing to the guy doing the rendering, they don't want to go back through that again. You know, the idea that you could get 95% of your farms negative and then have a cascade back is so scary for these guys in production that a lot of people don't want to try. I mean, you know, you got to kind of stand with them on that, because when I went to Oklahoma, the sow farms there, every farm broke, and one broke twice that first year. And that's not a fun situation. And if you think you're going to go down this path of eradication and get 3 or 4 years out and then have that happen again, you're going to avoid that possibility. So that's where I think, you know, anything we could study on different novel techniques of getting pigs immune earlier. I think the finishing has always been a key, certainly a key in high dense areas, you know. And if we had that nugget of information tested and improved a little bit, I think we'd be more likely to move forward.
And I can appreciate your discussion as a production system veterinarian myself and having PRRS fatigue, as you mentioned. But I think we need to also think about the process, right? And there was a discussion about pseudorabies eradication, comparing it to PRRS eradication. And, you know, you don't start at the high dense areas, right? Right. That's the last place you go, because it is going to be hard and it's seemingly sometimes impossible, but it is possible. Eradication, you know, has been around in epidemiology and veterinary medicine for a long time, but this virus is not an easy one. But I'm glad that we're talking about it. I'm glad that we're having discussions even like this with technologies that, you know, is hard to get good science on, because it's a different type of product, autogenous vaccine. So definitely appreciate our discussion today. So we're concluding our discussion on PRRS virus and how a U.S. swine production company manages the virus in their herd with Dr. Niels DeBuse, Steve Tusina. If you've got questions or comments for our guests about our show, please send those on your podcast platform. If you like our show, give us a thumbs up, share it to your friends. But before we wrap up, just any final thoughts from either of you on our discussion today?
Yeah, I wish we could have solved all of the PRRS questions today here in the 30 minutes that we've been together. But just words of encouragement for those out in the field today that are still wrestling with PRRS, right? Keep going, keep fighting, keep challenging the norms that are in your head. Reach out, ask a lot of questions, try new things. Don't be afraid.
Yeah, great advice. How about you, Neil?
I would say I'm optimistic about where we're at on PRRS, not just because National Pork Board has identified it as our number one problem, which is always good. You know, we're not in denial. It's our number one problem. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's been some incremental improvements that are really important for the industry. I think what AASB did about promoting just an understanding of where this, and they have a great publication out from AASB on how does recombination occur? What can we do to reduce the risk of that? I think it's overlooked a little bit as far as, I think we ought to talk about it more, but I think the new nomenclature for PRRS viruses, that's a huge step in the right direction. It enables the variant under monitoring. That's going to enable further evaluation, like we talked about with whole genome sequencing on some percentage of those really important isolates. I'm optimistic that we're going the right direction, but we still have to face some things that we have gaps in, significant gaps in, and fill those gaps.
It's time for our famous three.
Broiler Savvy, the pioneering AI-powered solution for broiler gut functionality and metabolic efficiency insights. Cargill Animal Nutrition and Health Pork Solutions delivers trusted, data-driven nutrition and business support, helping you build more profitable, confident pork systems. KT Pacer, 50 years designing and building feed transportation equipment focused on quality, workmanship, and performance. BinSentry, the most trusted feed monitoring solution in the world. Feed formulation software is stuck in the past, Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
Well, thank you guys very much. But before I let you go, as a hallmark of our SwineIt podcast show, we ask our guests three questions. And we're going to let Steve off the hook today. He's been on previous shows and shared those with us. So Neil's going to take all of these on himself. So Neil, our first question is, what's your favorite book or resource that you use in your area of expertise?
You know, I've had a secret most of my career. I have a mentor. And you know, when I came out of vet school, having mentors was a valuable thing. We talked a lot about it when I was with Steve Henry and Lisa Tokash that first year out. There were some peer groups. And so I've had this mentor, and I don't know if a lot of people know him, but Harvey Hilly was Al Lehman's first grad student at the University of Minnesota. He was a Texas A&M grad. We hit it off. I met him a year before I graduated from vet school. He's been an invaluable reference for me, and I use him frequently, even though he's not in pigs every day. During the core of my career, he was really a valuable non-political answer. He'd always give you the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So it was always, I always valued Harvey's input. So Harvey happened to be Bob Morrison's major professor, I think, when Bob came to the University of Minnesota. I don't know if you knew that, Steve. But.
Okay. Good.
Great.
Yeah.
So Neil, how about a book or resource outside of VetMed?
You know, I used to say this, and you know some of these people, Tara and Steve. I used to think I wasn't going to be a good swine veterinarian because I didn't have a brother who was in the pig business. Like, 40 Sprong's got a brother. Steve Henry's got a brother. You know, you can go down the list. There's a lot of, but I do have a brother who's a doctor. And one of the things, I wasn't around Al Lehman very much, but the summer I was a senior at Colorado State, I spent a couple of weeks with Al, and he was always saying, hey, you got to read a New England Journal of Medicine. He was always encouraging people to read about human health. Well, I've got a family doctor. I've got my little brother Mark is a doctor in the Navy. He's a great resource, especially on my knees. So I use Mark, but I think we all need to be paying attention to our own health and making sure we're staying on top of that as we get older and more frail.
Yeah, I understand the knees. The situation. All right. Last one, Neil, share with us an attribute or characteristic that you feel sets successful professionals apart from others.
You know, this one's fairly easy for me. I think that, you've got to be able to be brutally honest with yourself. I think you've got to say, hey, we're just not cutting it on this area. And I do this for myself. A lot of us have been incredibly successful in what we've done in our careers, successful for, you know, measured from a production standpoint or personal standpoint. But when you get into a deal like PERS and we're struggling, I don't think we can add up our successes and say, hey, we're going to make it. I think you really got to study the failures and say, hey, why did that happen? What did we miss on that one? So I think, one of the reasons I'm here at Kallenbach, Swine Management is that Paul Kallenbach believes that too. If you're brutally honest with yourself on the weaknesses, you'll get better faster. And I think it's a real key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes we learn more from our failures than our successes, for sure. I can attest to that. I was thinking of many PERS experiences as we were having this discussion on what I wouldn't do again. And I tell my mentees that as well, that don't be afraid to fail, right? Because that's really where you learn.
Yeah. Al had a funny saying, that I thought was just incredible, is that you shouldn't really worry about your employees making mistakes. You should just demand creativity. Don't let them make the same mistake over and over again. You know, get out there and make a new one so you can learn from it.
There you go. Well, great. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Appreciate all of your insight, and we'll look forward to the next time.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Tara. Appreciate the opportunity to talk to you guys.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with Elite Remote Talent with Appa Time Zone Hassle. delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.